Welcome to The Dark Divide, a podcast that takes a seat, dangles its legs over the edge, and stares into the abyss. This is the story of Anthony Tomaselli. Lauren Johnson gazed out the back window of her grandfather's car as her mother Mary Beth drove the three of them to Clearwater Beach to watch the sunset. Her grandfather, Anthony Tomaselli, had been doing this every single night for as long as she could remember. A creature of habit, he'd have dinner, watch Wheel of Fortune, and then say, "Let's go for a drive." Usually, his live-in girlfriend of 20 years, Shirley, would be in the car with them. But Shirley had passed away almost 2 weeks ago, and her grandfather's health was also on the decline. Not only that, but she could tell that his heart wasn't just weak, it was broken. After her grandmother had died, her Aunt Linda had introduced Shirley to her grandfather, and it turned out to be a match perfectly made. Linda was a medical assistant, and Shirley had been a patient of hers that she was sure would get along with her father, and she'd been right. Anthony had now outlived two great loves of his life, and she could tell that it was weighing on him. Lauren had moved in a couple days after Shirley's passing. Both her mother and her Aunt Linda couldn't move in with him, and he needed supervision. Lauren herself had just surfaced from an extremely difficult time involving both doing and selling drugs, struggles with her bipolar diagnosis, and suicide attempts. Her child was currently being raised by her sister, and Lauren's priority was continuing to stay on a productive path. She loved her grandfather. He was a sweet man, and even though he could be rough around the edges, it was only because he knew what he liked and what he didn't. And Lauren didn't feel like she had to constantly prove herself to him. Around her grandfather, she could just relax, accept her flawed and human past, and feel loved. Even if it didn't seem like much, having someone count on her and being able to follow through was a huge deal for Lauren. So it was nothing to her when her mom, aunt, and Uncle Charles approached her with the idea of moving in. Her grandfather had a guest room, and he wanted the company. At 85 years old, he didn't always need to be talking or interacting, but he just wanted someone there. It had only been over a week, but they'd already made a little routine together. She made sure he ate enough and didn't go to sleep too late. They'd sit down on Sundays and divide up his daily pills into a bright plastic container split up into the days of the week. When they got back from the beach, she'd make him his favorite drink, a little bit of vodka with some Diet Cola, and he'd watch a sports game until he was tired. Sometimes Lauren would duck out for a cigarette. A retired smoker himself, her grandfather had part of his lung removed from cancer a few years back, and it always made her feel a little guilty. "Sneak one for me," he'd joke to her. Earlier that day, Lauren had taken him to his doctor's appointment. He'd always had a cough, given his health history, but lately had been extra bad. After getting a chest x-ray done, Anthony was told that they'd found a spot on his lungs. Nothing too large or alarming, but of course, there's no time to waste with something like that. He'd had an appointment with a pulmonologist the next morning for further testing to see exactly what the next course of action would be. Between the unavoidable confrontation of his own mortality and the fact that Shirley was gone, she couldn't even begin to comprehend what her grandfather was feeling. Life always seemed so long. Tomorrow always seemed like such a sure thing. But as Lauren looked over at her grandfather, lit up by the oranges and pinks of the Florida sky, she felt such compassion for him, such admiration. He had a lot to be proud of. A retired barber, he'd done well by his family, and even now, continued to take care of his children and grandchildren however he could. He would be leaving behind a legacy that inspired Lauren and reminded her that it was never too late to start over. Later that night, her grandfather sat down with his prayer cards. The tiny little cardboard depictions of biblical scenes was something he always had on his person, ready to pull out of his pocket and recite in Italian. Her grandfather always sat on his recliner, but tonight he wanted to sit in Shirley's spot on the couch. During their time at the beach, he'd been calling different family members of hers, getting nostalgic and sad. Everything about today, about lately, must have been hitting him really hard. Her mother and Aunt Linda had decided to spend the night. Occasionally, they'd do that when they got the chance. Mary Beth would usually share the guest room with her daughter and Linda would take the couch. But as the baseball game went on, Lauren couldn't help but notice that her grandfather just wasn't himself. The last few days had been a lot for him. He was becoming more forgetful, and sometimes he'd call Lauren by her mother's name and call Mary Beth by her grandmother's name. He was tired, maybe a little apathetic. Hopefully in time he'd come around, at least emotionally. But tonight he hadn't finished his drink, and at one point his hand slowly released his prayer cards and he sort of went lifeless. He'd just started a new medication. Linda said maybe he was having a bad reaction. As long as nothing escalated, he'd be okay. Mary Beth noticed how stressed Lauren seemed, so she offered her something to sleep, and Lauren didn't hesitate. She hadn't slept in days, but the anxiety and perpetual worry about her grandfather wouldn't let her rest. Lauren had dabbled more in selling drugs and less in doing them, so not only did Mary Beth feel like it was fine to offer her daughter something, but the entire family trusted her to dole out medications left and right with no hesitation. Part of her worried. She just had this bad feeling, and her grandfather looked like he might have a stroke or something. But her Aunt Linda knew enough about medicine. They'd stay up and keep an eye on him. So Lauren swallowed the tiny pill, took a hot shower, and soon, the waves of sleep pulled her away from the bedroom and into a peaceful oblivion. It felt like Lauren had been asleep for just seconds when she woke up startled by the sound of her mother screaming. "He's gone, Linda, he's gone," as Lauren turned the corner into the living room. Her grandfather was on the floor, and her Aunt Linda, all 90 pounds of her, was on top of him, attempting CPR. Lauren's mother cried at her to call 911, so Lauren grabbed her cell phone and went to the bedroom. She could barely hear the operator on the other end over the sound of her mother's wailing. She told the operator exactly what her mother had said between screams, that she'd got up for work and found her father dead on the couch. Lauren's hands were clammy and shaky as she waited for the paramedics to arrive, as she watched her only real father figure in this world slowly slip away. The EMTs would have to tear Linda off of his body, her tiny fists hitting his chest, begging him not to go. The entire scene was so traumatizing. On the morning of March 6, 2015, at 5:50 a.m., Anthony Tomaselli was pronounced dead. Tony let the hot August sun shine down on his tan skin. He pressed down the strings on his guitar, effortlessly letting the chords come together in unison. He'd been booking more gigs lately and feeling really good about things. He was no stranger to struggle, and no stranger to chaos either. Anyone who knew Tony long enough had seen him through some pretty big ups and downs, and his current relationship wasn't doing the greatest. It seemed like they could never really decide if they were coming or going. In the midst of that messy in-between, he found himself in the middle of a few flings here and there. He just wanted to go with the flow. Que sera, whatever will be, and all that. He'd spent some time behind bars, and it had made him appreciate the little things in life and how they could be so big. He turned 53 that summer, and it wasn't that he was slowing down. His priorities were just changing. He didn't want fast money or bar brawls anymore. His desire now was something resembling stage lights and dimly lit rooms where he could watch the audience sway back and forth or kick up their heels and party. He mostly did covers, but every now and then he'd find some inspiration for an original. The further away he got from his past, the easier creativity came to him. "Music really is everything to me," he thought to himself as he looked out at the waves from his beach chair. Especially lately, after losing his mom in June, he found himself clinging to music like never before, finding comfort in old songs he knew better than the back of his own hand. No matter what he was going through, while he was strumming and singing, he felt better, even if just for a few minutes. He checked his watch. It was nearing time to head out for a show he was playing tonight. The Tampa Bay music scene was decent enough, and he could keep a pretty regular roster of booked shows at local bars. Tonight he was meeting a woman who'd hit him up on Facebook, Mary Beth. They exchanged a few messages, but she'd never seen him play before. She was a medical receptionist around 10 years his senior, and it sounded like it would be her kind of thing, so why not? He'd be lying if he said he didn't love the attention. When someone's first impression of you is you commanding a crowd from center stage, it's usually a pretty good one. Their connection instantly moved from platonic to sexual, and the first few times they saw each other, it always crossed that line. But Tony got the feeling that she was possessive and wanted way more than he was looking for right now. Mary Beth had a sister that was a couple years younger, and one night she introduced the both of them. Linda told him that she was a nurse, divorced from her jerk of a husband, and that she thought his music was great. What might have been an intention to show off her soon-to-be boyfriend, a hopeful Mary Beth realized that there was more chemistry than she wanted between Tony and Linda. When her sister asked for his number because she wanted him to help her with things around the house, Mary Beth had a feeling what was unfolding. She was no stranger to competition with her sister, and she was no stranger to losing. Even if things had been rocky from the get-go with Tony, she still didn't want her sister sleeping with him. "Whatever, you can have him," she told Linda. But she wasn't exactly letting her off the hook about it, because they would barely speak for months afterwards. Linda continued seeing Tony, and unfortunately, where they may have found common ground from failed past relationships, they would carry those same toxic traits into their own. She was half in the door, half out, with her abusive ex-husband, and when she wasn't riding that roller coaster, things between her and Tony would always end up tumultuous. He'd been the kind of guy to give in to those dramatics in the past, and it had landed him in hell. So now he had more of a no-bullshit attitude that immediately shut those antics down. It was easy for him to become cold and distant because, in all honesty, he wasn't that invested in Linda, not the way she was in him. He'd tell her that he couldn't handle the ups and downs, that things needed to cool off between them. But she would message him incessantly on Facebook. He would block her, only to have her make other accounts to keep contacting him through. Eventually, she'd be sweet and apologetic enough to him that he'd realize she was just obviously in a lot of pain. Hurt people, he thought, and they'd get back together. But after 6 months of it, he felt worn out. He didn't see himself actually having some sort of meaningful future with this woman, so maybe he was lying to himself as much as he'd been lying to her when it came to his true feelings. Whatever attraction he'd felt for her had been chiseled down every single time she flew off the handle until it was gone. They never really decided they were officially a thing, but regardless, Tony knew that he had to officially break this off, whatever it was. Linda begged him to at least come over and talk to her. She told him that she was finally ready to explain why she was acting so crazy, why she'd say and do the things she did. Tony ran through some scenarios. She wasn't really a big drinker, although she had mentioned messing around with a nightcap and some Ambien now and then, so maybe it was that. Or maybe it was something darker. Linda had spoken to him about her father's passing, a highlight of trauma in her life. She told him that all she really remembered was the EMTs tearing her off of his body because she just couldn't fathom that he was dead. Tony had met women like her before. Anyone who took a look at her romantic track record would probably guess she's got a few daddy issues. But there was always this strange sorrow in her eyes, even when she spoke about how she was his favorite. Something haunting. Tony took a deep breath in and sighed. If she needed to get childhood trauma out in the open to someone she trusted, he could be that person for her, no matter what they'd been through. 2 days before Valentine's Day, he thought. What a way to celebrate. Even though Linda was just a couple years younger than her sister, there was something about her that struck Tony as so meek, almost helpless. Beyond the ups and downs of their own tornado, he was aware that Linda was also no stranger to toxic patterns in her relationships. She complained about her most recent ex-husband, Ted, being an abusive jerk, but time and time again, she'd return to their on-and-off-again thing when she wasn't obsessing over Tony. But he wasn't ignorant to the fact that everyone has a past. Skeletons in their closet that rattle their bones long after something has ended. Once they sat down and Linda started talking about her father, he braced himself for a gritty tale of abuse. But her story didn't begin at childhood. It began 4 years ago. And within minutes, Tony realized that what he was hearing wasn't an explanation. It was a confession. A busy man tied to his phone, he pretended to answer a text message. "Sorry about that. Let me turn the sound off so you can have my full attention. No, start from the beginning again," he told her. But as he set his phone down sideways on his thigh, his thumb pressed the red button and started recording. The slanted angle would show Linda on her couch, across from where he sat in its matching chair. She's telling him about the night her father died. Anthony's health had been declining rapidly, according to Linda. And as a nurse, she couldn't stand the thought of him sick again. Their brother Charles wasn't around, and so the weight of his care fell on her and Mary Beth. That day in March 2015, when Lauren had taken him to the doctors and gotten results of a spot on his lungs, the sisters had made a decision regarding their father's suffering. They would end it. It would be simple and tidy. He would die peacefully in his sleep after they'd dose his vodka nightcap with pills. But things didn't go as planned. And right about when Tony began recording, Linda was explaining how Mary Beth had messed the whole thing up.
"So, what does she do? She makes a drink this big."
"Mary Beth?"
"Yes. Instead of making a little drink, she makes a big drink. Because the seven Halcyon, I think it was Halcyon when he was taken, which are very strong, would have been plenty enough to just let him go to sleep and sleep peacefully. So she makes a drink this big. Well, he can't drink a drink this big. So I looked at her and I said, "You fucked up."
Anthony Tomaselli liked a small amount of vodka and a small amount of Diet Coke in his drink. Linda had instructed her sister on how many pills to crush up and mix, but Mary Beth ended up giving him a much larger portion in a tall glass. After a few swigs, it was then that his prayer cards tumbled out of his hands and he began to slowly lose motor skills. Later, Lauren will learn that the pill she'd been given by her own mother wasn't to relax her anxiety and help her sleep, but to knock her out as a witness from what would happen next. Tony, in shock and disbelief, keeps asking clarifying questions, and Linda pauses, telling him, "This is very hard for me. I've never told anybody this, and obviously I would deny it if you ever told anybody." But he assures her that he has nobody to tell, and what would be the point? According to her, the body was cremated and an investigation was completed by the sheriff's department. No autopsy was done because of his health history, and the cause of death was considered natural. But Tony knew that this was still a confession to murder. He knew it still had to count for something, and it wasn't hard to get details out of Linda. For as tough as this apparently was for her, she was eager to shut down his interrupting and recall the story in full detail, like she had in her mind every single day for the last 4 years. Tony doesn't go out of his way to handle her delicately, and he even outright tells her, in shock, what he can barely believe himself. But she's quick to make sure he knows that she only holds half the blame, and literally cringes at the idea that what they did to their father was anything but selfless.
"You killed your father 4 years ago."
"You have to say it like that?"
"Well, but
and
that's..."
"Don't just say it to me, because it was my sister too."
"And Mary Beth."
"Correct. We euthanized him. We didn't kill him."
"Well, euthanasia is not legal."
"Well, it is, because hospice does it all the time. They give you the lethal dose of morphine. I've seen it. I've done it myself."
Both assisted suicide and euthanasia are extremely complex and controversial topics, not just in the medical community, but society as a whole. Only several states in the U.S. participate in these laws, and each has their own case-by-case requirements. Florida is not one of them. Sometimes a doctor knowingly assists someone in ending their life, also known as assisted suicide, often in situations of a terminal illness, diagnosis, or extreme unrelenting suffering. The methods are effective, quick, and most importantly, painless. Often the patient is given a lethal dose, and if and when they take it is up to them. Euthanasia is when a doctor is allowed to end a person's life painlessly, and this can sometimes be non-voluntary, meaning that a person's family member or legal representation can also make that decision. Linda was a medical assistant who liked to amplify the title to nurse, even though that was a bit of a stretch. And her over-exaggerated expertise was apparently a firm pillar in the foundation of her decision. In Linda's eyes, there was no option besides playing God because their father didn't know what was best for him. He was stubborn and refused to go into a senior living care facility where he could be taken care of, and most importantly, not their problem anymore. Tony catches on to a few things while Linda is spilling her guts. First, that this gentle euthanasia was filled with a lot more malice and resentment than she was letting on. Maybe not on Linda's part, he couldn't be sure at this point, but she described a horrible screaming match between Mary Beth and her father regarding him moving to the care facility. She'd been fed up, and that anger had been an ingredient in their evil plot. "You don't know my sister," Linda told him. "She's got a temper 10 times the size of mine." And as for this far-fetched image of euthanasia, Linda kept contradicting herself about how sick her father actually was. She described the situation similar to a hospital, telling Tony that he had a DNR in his will. A do not resuscitate order is a medical order indicating that a person should not receive life-saving services if their heart stops beating. But Anthony's heart hadn't stopped beating. Anthony hadn't asked anyone to help him end his suffering. This was a man that apparently could walk and talk and drink his nightly vodka just fine. He could say his prayers, he could go for drives to the beach. Sure, he was getting names and faces confused, but he was an 85-year-old cancer survivor. He was far from knocking on death's door. And that's exactly why their plan didn't go as smoothly as they expected. Anthony's body put up a fight, and so did Anthony himself.
"So anyway, he went to sleep."
"Okay."
"We thought he was..."
"Dead?"
"Dead."
"And? He wasn't?"
"He opened his eyes."
"He opened his eyes?"
"And he looked at us."
"He looked at you."
"And I said, now what do we do?"
"You asked her now what to do?"
"I said, what do we do now?"
"So then what?"
"I don't know if I can even tell the rest of it."
"You put a pillow over his face."
"Yeah, we did. Not a pillow, but we did. And it's pretty beating us."
By pinching his nose? Did you pinch your father's nose? How did you do it?
I can't talk anymore.
What do you mean you can't talk? You already told me. This is the only way to get it off your chest. You've never told anybody. You might as well finish, so I know, and you know, that the truth has been told. Did you pinch his nose and hold his mouth? I mean, that's very personal. That's probably why you're having problems right now, mental problems. Which you do, by the way.
Not me, but we did.
Who pinched his nose?
She did.
And did you hold his mouth?
I put a washcloth in it.
You put a washcloth in his mouth?
Mm-hmm.
How can you live with yourself?
Unable to totally buy this bogus idea that it was all for her father's peace, he asks if money was a part of their whole reasoning behind this, but she swears up and down that it had nothing to do with it. All three of Anthony's children would receive insurance split equally, giving them each around $110,000. No small amount, but that wasn't what they were after. He was just so stubborn, Linda told him. He refused to go to the care facility. And Linda just couldn't bear the thought of her father's chest being cut open once again, having to see her hero with tubes sticking out of his body and machines pumping life into him. She'd seen hundreds of patients suffer through their last days in a hospital bed, and she decided that wasn't how she would say goodbye to her father. Linda's ego, mixed with an intense level of self-deception, makes it impossible for Tony to reach a breakthrough point, where her reality shifts from something selfless to an act of murder. She refuses to see what she did as harmful. She refuses to entertain any idea that she could have been wrong. She tells him that it was the only option left at that point. And where Linda is willing to take 100% of the credit for her ability to assess what needed to be done, she's only 50% willing to take the blame.
You knew that he was going to die. Well, you say you knew he was going to die, but you don't really know. You heard from a doctor that he was going to die. Did you ever hear of a misdiagnosis? Did you ever hear that? Please tell me you've been in the medical profession. Have you ever heard of a doctor amputating the wrong leg?
Yeah.
Have you ever heard him saying, I'm sorry to tell you this, your father's got
What are you trying to do? Make me feel... What do you want me
I'm
to
just
do?
Saying, have I'm,
I know
I'm pissed
I
off.
Did
I'm
was
pissed
wrong.
Off. I'm pissed off. That you murdered your own father. And you said he was the greatest guy ever.
He was. That's why we did it. Because we
No, you
him.
Said Mary Beth was actually mad at him, so she was angry and she had a temper. She was happy to murder him for different reasons. True?
I wanted to put him out of his misery.
But she was mad at him. True?
Yes, she was mad at him.
So it could be said that she did it with malice. You know what I mean? In a way?
We use the word put him out of his misery.
But she was mad at him. You just admitted it.
Linda tells him that she's seen so many doctors and nurses do the exact same thing. Give a little extra dose here, a little extra dose there. Tony gets nervous, thinking maybe this isn't just some one-off murder. What if he's sitting across from some angel of death? What if this tiny, meek woman who flew off the handle once in a while had actually been taking her pain out on unsuspecting patients for years? He tried getting names from her, but she can't give him any. And as far as Linda is concerned, if nobody knows, it didn't happen. I don't look at it as killing him, she says. We were thoroughly investigated. In her eyes, if Linda could get away with the crime, then a crime hadn't even taken place. Tony tries using different examples of how even when someone's professionally involved in death, there's still an investigation about whether it was justified, about whether it was a crime. He uses the example of a police officer shooting a bank robber, but Linda plays dumb. Almost smug, she reminds him that there was no autopsy done and his body was burned to ash, so even if they had committed a crime, it's too late. There's nothing to justify anymore. The glimpses of narcissism are chilling. And it's then that Tony remembers something Linda told him once, when she had initially described her father's passing and how traumatic it had been for her.
10 hours to investigate.
But you told me, the one thing you did tell me about your father is that you tried to give your father CPR, and that's the one, see, that's a lie. Now you have to admit that's a lie. You're like, I was giving my, yes.
It's a lie.
It's a lie.
I knew he was dead.
You knew he was dead. But you said that the paramedics...
I knew he was dead because he had...
Because you killed him.
Because he had peed his pants. And I knew he was... Yes, I knew he was dead.
But you did it for more of a show. When the paramedics came in, you were doing chest compressions. Admit it.
Admit it. I admit it.
because then there's like, they used to, because you told me early on when I first met you, you're like, this terrible thing happened. I had to give my own father chest compressions and I couldn't get off of him because I just wouldn't accept that he wasn't dead.
At that point, it is true. I was probably in my mind trying to revive him.
No, you weren't. You knew he was dead.
I knew he was dead, but I thought maybe I could breathe him back to life.
When the paramedics...
I know, I'm a terrible person, so what do you want me to do?
You called the paramedics, and when you called them, they came, and that's when you started chest compressions.
No, I started them immediately when I walked over to him, because I thought maybe he didn't die.
Oh, really? So the paramedics got there, and you were still doing chest compressions. They had to pull you off, you said.
Yes.
But just 2 seconds ago, you said you admit it. I said you were doing chest compressions... just for show, I admit it. And you said, yes, I admit it.
What is this, judge and jury now?
But you admitted it 2 seconds ago. You said, I admit it. You knew he was dead. You were just doing that for show. More than trying to save him because you knew he was dead. You're not stupid. But doing the chest compressions when the paramedics walked in was a nice touch.
He'd been there less than an hour, but it felt like he'd been sitting there for days. Linda was circling the same things over and over, admitting and then recanting, but he figured he had everything he needed. Honestly, he didn't want to hear anymore. It was all so ugly and dark. He just couldn't believe that this 61-year-old woman he'd been watching movies and sharing meals with, sharing a bed with, was capable of something so cruel.
It's terrible.
I'm a terrible person.
Is
that what you're telling me?
I don't know. I mean, I'm always one wearing the black cowboy hat, but I've never murdered anybody, and I never thought I could come close to it unless they were hurting me or my family. I think I could probably do it to protect, but never to end a life because I thought it was my right.
Well, you didn't work in the medical profession for 30 years.
Fuck that, Linda. That doesn't give you...
Begging you to help them die.
That's not your place. You're not God. You're not judge, jury, and executioner or God. You know that, right? That's why you fear hell right now. True? Yes. Because you know people aren't supposed to do that and other people's lives.
But do I have a choice when my life ends, where I'm going? No.
No.
I don't. Okay, so now have I ended enough of our relationship for you?
I think that what you did was reprehensible, and I just can't imagine you living with yourself.
By now, any fly on the wall would have caught on that Tony isn't just observant and curious. He's practically interrogating her. He'd seen a forensic files or two. He's asking for names, dates, locations, and addresses. He's clarifying elements, motive, timeline, and testimony. He's establishing a full story from beginning to end, and Linda is giving him every single breadcrumb he wants without much hesitation. He even asks if she's sober and sound of mind, and finds a way for both of them to confirm the date and time that it currently is. Whether naive or delusional, in her mind, baring her soul and handing over the deepest, darkest secret she has is a desperate attempt to prove how much she trusts Tony, how badly she needs him, and how horribly her life has gone for her. And she was completely unaware that it wasn't working at all. He figures that if he's got her on camera, outright admitting to murdering her father, then that should be enough for the police. Because even though he reassured Linda the entire time that there was no way he would tell a soul, there was no way he was holding this secret. He'd been raised Catholic. He believed in heaven and hell, and also, he believed in redemption. He'd done his time and paid his dues for his wrongs. Was he perfect? Far from it. But what he wasn't was an accessory after the fact. And if Linda thought she'd spotted something favorable in him that would hold this darkness, she was wrong. The next day, two detectives sit down with Tony, who is more cautious and well-versed than maybe the average person sitting across from a police officer. He's there to give them the secret recording that he took of Linda, but no more than that, and he makes it clear that he's brought everything required to make the transfer for the video, but he won't be handing over any of his personal devices. It's his right to want to keep himself out of the equation as much as possible, given his involvement was so minimal. Tony wasn't thrilled to be there, and the last thing he expected to be doing on a Wednesday morning was handing over what could possibly be the key to a crime that had gone totally unnoticed. So many nights, he'd sat on his couch, lit up by the glow of some murder show, wondering what it would feel like to be on the other side. Well, it wasn't great. They ask him how he met the sisters, having to pull a little to get him to admit that there was more than something platonic going on. He explains dating Mary Beth first, and then Linda, which Mary Beth hates him for. Things didn't stay rosy with Linda for very long either, and they'd ended things recently, but that hadn't stopped her from texting him and calling him all the time. She'd just been on a week-long cruise, and the second the ship had docked, she'd wanted him to come over.
So you guys ended up, did you guys get into an altercation of some fight, or just,
no, she
who
just
ended it?
She just got on my nerves, texting me stuff too much. I ended up blocking her on Facebook and phone, and she got another account. She started contacting me again, and I felt sorry for her in a lot of different ways, so I talked to her a little bit more. But that's, I know you want as much as you can get, but that's sort of the least of it, how we came together.
So then what happened yesterday? How'd you guys meet up yesterday? How did that come about?
She asked me to come over, said she needed to talk about something. She called me.
Given that he's only known both women for less than a year, he could only tell them what he knows from her story, which is still a lot. When the officers ask him if there'd been any drugs or alcohol involved when that conversation happened, Tony tells them no, he's never actually seen Linda drink, and he's spent a meaningful amount of time with her. Once she chalked up a night of insane text messages to Ambien sleeping pills, but overall, she wasn't a person to abuse substances. Mary Beth, on the other hand, liked to let loose. Tony had followed her once, taking a video and sending it to her after she drove home drunk to show her how badly she'd been. Unlike Linda, who was naive to a fault, Mary Beth was aware that Tony followed the rules more than she'd assumed. While they're figuring out how to get the tech department involved to transfer video files and text messages, Tony describes the tale of horror that he'd just learned not even 24 hours before.
I assume that I'm helping her divulge something that happened to her as a child that she had repressed. And I do like her. She's a nice lady in a lot of ways. And so I felt bad at what she was about to tell me. I thought. Mm-hmm. And she says, "You don't understand. I've never told one soul. Nobody knows. I've never told anybody. The only person that knows is my sister. She knows." I said, "Oh, geez, this is going on with her as well." I said, "Tell me." She said, "It's nothing sexual, if that's what you're thinking." I was like, "That's what I was thinking. You're damaged from sexual abuse as a child." She said, "No." I said, "Then what is it?" And she said, "I ended my father's life."
He laid the entire thing out as best he could from start to finish, giving details that he couldn't possibly have known unless somebody who was there the night Anthony died had told him. These sisters had plotted to kill their father, whether for revenge, money, or otherwise, and she told him exactly how, when, and where. He wasn't even sure if recording somebody secretly was legal, but his gut had told him he needed proof. He understood to a certain degree that having a relationship with sisters, both not ending well, and then coming in to accuse them of murder seemed more like a plot from a book than real life. But it was true. He had no ulterior motives. He hadn't asked for this information. It had just fallen into his lap.
And I was also shocked that someone was telling me they murdered somebody. Mm-hmm. So I was like, so that's how the conversation started. Why are you telling me this when you told me you tried to save him? Mm-hmm. And then I knew right away that this was something I might record, because I never heard somebody tell me they killed somebody before. So I started the recorder. Whether it was something I am allowed to do or not, I don't know. I did it.
In defense of the investigators, even though a confession from his ex-lover seems like a nonsensical way to get back at someone after a bad breakup, the hesitation to fully buy in probably comes from how well-versed Tony is. He uses terms like patricide and corpus delicti like an armchair detective. In reality, he was just as scared as he was curious. He didn't want the police to be fooled by these women, and he didn't want two murderers out on the loose, aware that he'd snitched.
Again, I'm asking out of curiosity. I don't know how you guys go about any of these things that you do, but is having a confession, either this and or something else, enough to convict an old murderer?
Well, there's a lot of things that we have to do on the back end.
I understand that.
I can't disclose all that.
Well, no, this is just like we're talking. So I met you in a bar. I'm like, hey, can you solve those murders when someone confesses? Is that enough? Or do you have to have a corpus delicti or whatever? You know what I mean? Like,
go ahead and send the other one.
I'm just asking.
As if her ears were ringing, Linda calls Tony in the middle of a sentence about her. The police ask him to ignore it. He can call her back after the interview. And once the files are finally transferred and they've skimmed a minute or two of the video, they ask him if he's willing to wear a wire. Linda's expecting him, and she seems trusting and eager to give details. So maybe she'll offer up more, and they can instruct him on a few specifics to ask.
I just hope it's the right thing as far as you can do something about it. I would hate to think that I came forward with this, and then you're just like, well, it's 4 years old, he's cremated,
oh, no.
I can't do anything.
No. I work on very old cases, so I'm just saying that that's 4 years is not that long.
Okay, a 4-year-old case with a confession, I mean, again, you can't promise anything, but is that something that is prosecutable? Is a confession? I mean, I'm just wondering if a confession, either this or if I get anything else for you, is that prosecuted? Is that something that's...
It can be, but there's a lot of aspects of this that we have to look at.
We have to do a lot of work before, you know, or so forth. So we're just, let's see the video, and then we'll go do that. We'll try to maybe have you go talk to her.
We'll do that.
If you're willing to do that.
I'm willing to do it.
Okay, we appreciate that.
I won't be able to live with it if I don't.
When Tony arrives, he and Linda make a little small talk about the condo she's in the process of getting with her ex-husband, Ted, who she's once again decided to go back to. She immediately starts telling him that they've worked out a deal where Ted's half goes to her if he dies, and her half goes to her daughter. She sounds proud. Whether on purpose or just naturally his morbid sense of humor, Tony can't help but see only the sinister side of this entire conversation.
Okay, if he dies before me, the condo's mine. If I die before him...
Which is not likely.
Well, I don't know. It's pretty healthy.
Well,
but my
I think you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. No, that's not funny. That is not funny.
Well, I'm trying not to make light of it, but...
That's not funny. I don't do that.
What if you get pissed off at him, would you...
No, I could have killed him many times. And gotten away with it.
He tells her in all seriousness, he can't stop thinking about what she told him yesterday. It's been weighing on him. He reminds her about his mother's recent passing. He said that he just couldn't imagine putting himself in that position. But Linda reassures him that it's all right. She has dreams of her father. He's standing at the foot of her bed, looking calmly at her. He tells her that it's okay. But Tony isn't buying that. He doesn't understand how she can feel so okay about this. Linda explains that she did what any nurse would have done, describing the situation as if her father was dealing with an unbelievable amount of suffering, with very little time to live. She tells him that that would have been the standing order if he was in hospice, to just give him enough morphine to kill him. And yet he wanted a drink of vodka. Tony rebuffed the idea that he was incapable of functioning, and it certainly didn't sound like her father had asked for this. It wasn't hospice. And it wasn't morphine. Well, that's what morphine would have done anyway, Linda replied. It would have stopped his breathing. Linda refused all logic. She didn't seem fazed about how personal her crime had been, pinching his nose and stuffing his mouth with a cloth. It was an image that Tony couldn't get out of his mind.
But I keep thinking about the personal nature of you actually pinching his nose.
I didn't pinch his nose.
Who pinched his nose?
She did, Mary.
Mary Beth? Mm. But you put a washcloth in his mouth.
Well, he had to stop the breathing somehow. Oh, then I didn't want to put a pillow over his head. I mean, at that point, it was of no return. Do you understand?
No, I don't. No return from where? I mean, what? Who? You determined the hour that he would stop breathing, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, and the kicker was my dad had a pacemaker. So I'm taking his pulse and his heart is beating, but he's dead. Because the pacemaker was making his heart beat.
What do you mean that's the kicker? Do you think that was funny?
No, it was terrible because I thought he was still alive because he had a pulse. And I wasn't thinking in my head, my father has a pacemaker.
even though you had shoved a rag in his mouth, and you know he stopped breathing.
Stop it.
What do you mean, stop
it? What do you
it?
Want me to go crazy? Are you trying to make me crazy?
Are you crazy?
No.
Are you sane?
Yes.
Do you know right from wrong?
Yes, I do.
Do you feel it was right or wrong?
I feel that I did put my father, I euthanized him. That's what I did. Just like hospice does.
As the conversation progresses, Tony nudges his way into nurse territory. He again attempts to see if Linda will start giving names or faces to all these countless patients that she supposedly witnessed doctors giving the deadly dose to. She recalls the name of one woman, but can't give specifics of what happened. She saw hundreds of cancer patients who begged her to put them out of their misery. He's naive to think that hospice isn't doing this all the time, if not most of the time, with all the people in their care. Tony tells her that he thinks that's ridiculous to believe. Check it out, she says. And then he challenges her confession about her father, yet again being a prime candidate for a wired conversation.
What if I said I don't believe you about this story about stopping your dad's breathing? What if I just said I thought you're making it up to scare me or something, scare me from you? What?
It happened.
It happened. You're not just trying to scare me?
Are you scared of me?
Not really, but you do have a 38.
Oh, come on. Would never shoot someone unless a stranger came through that door and when it came into my bedroom. And I knew they were not.
I'm not scared of you, but you're so meek to think that you actually murdered your father.
I did not murder him.
Oh, I'm sorry. Euthanize?
Yes.
Linda uses Shirley, her father's partner who died 2 weeks before him, as an example. Shirley had a complicated medical history, like her parents and siblings. She'd had triple bypass surgery, an open heart procedure to treat clogged arteries, by the age of 32. Linda had met her as a patient and set the two of them up. And when she died, she was convinced that hospice had administered a lethal dose.
Wow, who killed her?
Nobody. Yes, hospice killed her.
Oh, hospice. Were you involved in that?
Yes, I was at the end of the bed rubbing her legs. They were like balloons.
And did you say to the hospice, go ahead and give her more morphine? I condone that?
No, because she was not my mother. I had no legal right to say anything. But I knew they were giving her the dose that night.
So this is no...
I had eye contact with that nurse.
Yeah?
And I knew they were going to call us. 3 o'clock in the morning, they called us and told us she died.
You knew it because you made eye contact with her?
I made eye contact.
And what is it, an unspoken between nurses, this is time for the more morphine?
No. Shirley was saying that she was in horrible pain, and I just looked over to the nurse. The nurse didn't know me from Adam, didn't know what I did, didn't know anything about me. And I just made eye contact with her, and she said, I think you all should say goodbye for tonight to Shirley. Say goodbye to her. Say goodbye, and I think you guys need to go. Your family needs to go home now. I knew then that was the night they were doing it, and they did it.
And likewise, when it came to her father, the doctor had told them that his time was limited. Of course his time was limited, Tony challenged, but isn't everyone's? He could have died that night, that week, or he could have lived for weeks, months, maybe even years. Why couldn't you and Mary Beth just let that happen? In his eyes, she should have let God decide what God is in control of. But she says she did the right thing, and when he left yesterday, and she looked in the mirror, she didn't see a person who did anything wrong. But if it's just hospice, if it's just selfless love that's fueled this whole thing, then why did the two of them keep this dirty secret to themselves? Why hasn't Linda told anyone else? He tries to make her see her own logic is constantly contradicting itself.
That's probably why I've never told anybody.
Because they would shove it in your face that it's murder.
Yeah.
Yes, but it is. Say it. Say murder.
No, I did not murder my father.
Please.
I feel I put him out of his misery.
Did you stop his breathing and try to use Halcyon? Yes, that's murder. Why can't you say the word? You're never going to heal if you don't.
I'm not going to say it.
The way he went was anything but peaceful, and Linda reverts back to how that's Mary Beth's fault. She told Mary Beth that he would need at least 15 to fall asleep and die. She'd told her. But she'd messed the drink up, and he most likely only got 6 or 7 into his system, enough to knock him out, not enough to kill him. In the middle of his prayers, he dropped the cards. Even that image haunted Tony, he told her. The idea that maybe this man was praying, maybe in his final hours he was trying to get right with God, and she stole that from him. But Linda, unfazed and out of touch, replies that she kept his prayer cards and his wallet to remember him by. Did you keep the rag you used? He asked her, and she says no. She washed it and threw it away. And then, without prompting, Linda asks him if he wants another scenario, and she starts telling him about her mother.
Okay, let's go to my mother, 62 years old.
Yes.
She had a massive brain hemorrhage.
Okay.
Okay, she was brain dead.
Mm-hmm.
She had, in the hospital, DNR.
DNR.
Not resuscitated.
Right.
Okay, that means you do not keep them alive with anything artificially to keep them, their heart beating, or keep them oxygen, anything. My mother chose that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we were all in the room, and the nurse and I were talking, and my mom had an IV line running into her. She was unresponsive, had the brain scan done, flatline, dead, vegetable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The only thing keeping my mother alive was that IV.
Right.
Because it had a heart medication in it that was okay. Making her heartbeat.
Yes.
But she was dead.
She was dead. And? You removed the line?
No, I did not remove it. But everybody left the room, and because my mother was dying.
Right.
And I have a wimpy family, I guess. I was a strong one.
You're the strong one?
I worked in medicine.
You worked in medicine. So when they left the room,
the nurse said, "What would you don't leave your mother," she said. "Don't let your mother die alone. She said, stay here with her."
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So she shut the door, and she looked at me, and she said, "You know that this IV is against your mother's will, don't you?" And I said, "Yes, I do." She says, "Give me permission to stop this IV." And I said, "Yes, you have my permission to stop it." And she did. And my mother died in 30 seconds.
Who was this nurse?
My mother's the nurse. What was on?
What year was this?
Well, she was 62. I was 40 years old. Or 37 when my mom died. Wait. So, are you going to blame me for that one, too?
You told her to, kind of.
How?
Because
she had a DNR, and my father didn't understand that DNR covered that IV. And the nurse said to me, your mother does not want this. It's her wishes.
But
it's in writing.
Okay, but hold on a second. Now we're getting into another layer here. Your father is the first one to make that decision. If your father wanted that IV, and he wanted to keep your mother alive, the love of his life, why couldn't he do that? Whether he has a DNR or not, he still
has... My mother had that choice. You have that choice.
Okay, but listen. Still, why does everything fall apart?
Vegetable, it doesn't matter.
Why does everything fall on Linda...
Legally, it...
Why does everything fall on Linda Roberts to make the decision who dies?
It so happened that it did fall on me. It wasn't... The nurse told me, please give me permission to turn this IV off. Your mother...
You didn't touch the pickcock?
Touched it. I was holding her hand. She turned the IV off.
I just don't see how you justify that one either. Who's next? What family member is next?
Stop it!
It's not funny. I mean, hey, look, so-and-so's only got 8 months to live. Let's stop them now. We can get their inheritance.
My mother was dead.
If you say so.
To her own detriment, Linda is more interested in proving Tony's arguments wrong than realizing that maybe he's not as compliant as she assumes he is with this knowledge. He tells her how chilling it is to think of the typical idea of a murderer. And here she is, a killer hiding in plain sight because she's the most unsuspecting person ever.
You know, we're not going to hurt my feelings if you tell me you don't want to see me ever
It's not
again.
That. It's not that. That's not it. I'm not afraid of you. But in a way, I am. I mean, you're the kind of killer I see. I always watch those forensic shows.
Yeah, and I think it's getting to your brain.
What do you mean?
Because I do not kill people.
Yeah, listen, I watch those forensic shows on TV. They solve these crimes about people that kill people for different reasons. And the people that do the murders always think they have a good reason. Like they needed money, or they needed the house, or they needed a piece of artwork.
But that's not why we did.
Okay, well, Mary wanted the money. Be honest.
Speaking of Mary Beth, she'd be coming home soon, and they couldn't say a word when she got in, Linda reminded him. And whatever weight he was feeling, it would get easier with time. like with his mother's passing. A work call interrupts their conversation, and it's time for Tony to get going. But he says once more that he thinks it's time for her to face the facts, that she's committed murder. Linda starts to cry, saying she's not sure if she can talk to him later, or ever again. "I'm sorry if I upset you. I'm sorry if you think I'm a terrible person," Linda says as he's heading out. "I don't think you're bad. I just think you're really confused, and I think you've been confused for a long time in your life. And I think you need help, Linda." And with that, Tony closes the door and heads out to give the police the wire under his shirt. What had been a crime under the radar was now about to become a slam dunk in the courtroom. Mary Beth was arrested just before 9 a.m. at her workplace. She walks into the funeral of her freedom, wearing a black sweater dress, black tights, black shoes, and sits down at a small table with two officers. After verifying basic information, the main officer who is going to lead the interrogation explains to her that he likes honesty, and he can tell just from looking at her that she's an honest person. They assure her that she's about to find out why she's here, and then she's read her Miranda rights, reminding her that it's her right to remain silent or refuse questioning and request a lawyer. They spend another few minutes telling her how honest she is, how they appreciate her upfront attitude on the way over in the car. They confirm that she has children, and just like how she raised her children to admit their mistakes and learn from them, they're going to need her to do that today too. Mary Beth is nodding in agreement and asks if she can have a tissue first. When the officer comes back, he doesn't even have to finish his sentence.
So Mary Beth, like I explained, you know why.
I just saw a picture of my father.
Okay. So, and you know why we're here. And you know why you're here. Okay? Yes, so right now, and I could tell things have been bothering you. And I know it's not. So I want to hear from you what happened.
Okay, what happened?
Yes, ma'am.
Mary Beth then explains her version of what happened that night. She tells them about Shirley's passing and that her father's dementia was getting so bad he couldn't be left alone for even 1 minute. He would stay up all night, drinking heavily, smoking cigarettes constantly, even though he was a cancer survivor. And the worst part was that they just found out he had a large mass on his lung. She was watching his health decline at a rapid rate that was too painful for her. Both her and Linda were unable to give him the support he needed, and Mary Beth stands up and slams the table to mimic how her father had screamed at her that night when they argued over him going to the living facility. She remains soft-spoken throughout the entire thing, even when demonstrating what Linda had described as a horrible screaming match. Linda had told Tony more than once that Mary Beth had a temper 10 times worse than hers, and Tony didn't doubt it because he'd seen some pretty ugly sides of Mary Beth himself. She tells the officers that they worked out a situation for her oldest daughter, Lauren, to move in with her father and help him out. She'd been through a lot with her over the years. Suicide attempts, finding treatment that worked for her bipolar disorder, taking care of her child while she was in jail. Lauren had been putting the pieces of her life back together, and she'd been at her father's place for more than a week. But after the news of a mass on his lungs, the sisters started coming up with a remedy of their own.
This one night, I came home and my sister, who's in the medical field, she's a certified medical assistant.
Oh, she's an assistant?
A CMA.
Okay.
What's her name?
Okay.
Linda Roberts.
Okay, continue.
She said to me that she had been thinking about Dad and his situation with his lung cancer coming back, with what we're going to deal with, his dementia, him not understanding, and what it was going to be like for him. And he was, the way we felt he was suffering, the way we felt he was suffering, that we, she said, she thought that perhaps we could put him out of his suffering.
Okay.
Was this a conversation you had in person or over the phone?
No, together.
We were together as a
house. We were laying in bed together.
Okay, just making sure I understand what we're saying. Yeah. Okay, continue. Sorry.
So you guys were laying in bed. It was you and your sister.
Yeah.
Okay. And this was that Wednesday?
I believe it was a Wednesday.
So then what did you say to that?
Well, at that moment, after everything, the way things were at this time, I had hesitations. However, I felt, I understand I don't have the right to take someone's life, if that's what you're asking me.
Okay.
I know right from wrong.
Okay.
However, I felt I couldn't see my father at 88 going through, sorry, I can't shut up.
That's okay.
Going through this surgery. I didn't think he was going to make it through this surgery, this dementia. I couldn't watch my father suffer this way.
Okay.
So what, I agreed with her.
And what was the plan?
Her plan was...
She continues to tell them about how Linda instructed her to make the drink with about 15 sleeping pills, and it would allow him to gently go peacefully in his sleep. She was unaware that Linda had given her daughter Lauren something as well, and said that she was asleep in the spare bedroom. Was it the hardest thing I ever did? She says. Yes. However, the drink didn't work. It affected him, but he didn't pass away.
So he was kind of struggling around. And at this point, you can't, you had seconds. This, after this, wasn't planned. After this, what to do next.
Okay.
I followed her lead.
Okay.
And so she said, okay, now we had to be quiet. She said, let's put a pillow over Dad's face.
Okay.
And that didn't work because he was strong.
So who
he
did,
was strong.
Who put...
I don't remember which one of us put the pillow over his face.
And where was your dad when you were
He's
doing
on the couch.
So he was
in the living room.
In the living room.
Understood.
It was real quiet.
Okay.
It didn't... No one... There wasn't any... No, I'm not smiling.
I understand.
And that wasn't working because he was very strong and he was pushing it off. And so she said, okay, the next thing we'll have to do is we have to get a washcloth and put it in his mouth, and one of us is going to have to hold his nose and...
Hold his arms.
Had to finish what we had started.
Okay, so...
Linda shoved the washcloth into her father's mouth, while Mary Beth fought to hold him down and pinch his nose. It gets foggy for her there, she says. She didn't black out, but it was a strange, out-of-body experience, and it felt like it was over very quickly. When they realized he was dead, they went to bed, waiting for their normal time to get up for work, waiting for when their show for Lauren would begin. After calling 911, the investigation with the sheriff's department had been a breeze because they'd done nothing out of the ordinary of their father's normal routine. Mary Beth explains that even though they lied, she felt like they did the right thing. And when the officer asks her if she still feels that way, she might as well have said, I did it, and I'd do it again if I had to.
And what about now?
What about now?
What do you think now?
I think I did the right thing.
When they ask her if there's anyone else besides the two of them who would know, Mary Beth doesn't miss the chance to tell them exactly what kind of person she thinks Tony is.
Now, let me ask this. Who else have you told about this or talked about it? I know who was there, but since this point...
The only person is this monster of a man.
Mary Beth says that one day last week when she got home from work... He was there waiting for her, which surprised her because she's had nothing to do with him since they stopped dating and he started seeing Linda. During their fling, Mary Beth's other daughter, Jennifer, who works for a judge, had looked up his record, seen things she didn't like, and told Mary Beth all the details. Even though Linda also knew, she'd decided to still date him behind Mary Beth's back. But according to Mary Beth, he didn't just go there to confront her. He tried to blackmail her and said if she didn't sleep with him, he'd go to the police. He's a monster, she told him. How dare he? Some man with a stack of injunctions look down on her lack of morals? She was unaware that by this point, Tony had already gone to the police. And the idea that he'd break the law in the midst of assisting them was ludicrous, but the officers just kept letting her talk. Mary Beth was done with Tony, but her sister was jealous and convinced that the two of them still had something going on. And even though she wants to remain stoic, Mary Beth's feelings towards her sister and this messy love triangle start to surface.
She did a horrible thing. She continued to see him. She was home all day. She had nothing to do. She's not stupid. She's a very smart person. But she had nothing to do all day, and her mind just did twisted things. She's evil. I'm sorry.
Your sister is?
Yes. Evil person.
Now that Mary Beth had confessed, detectives focus in more on specific details and motive. According to her, a lot of what Linda had said to Tony was a lie. He was under the impression that Mary Beth was angry, broke, and out for money, but she argued that she'd filed bankruptcy after her divorce 18 years ago, and that money had nothing to do with her decision to kill her father. It wasn't even that much money, and besides, whatever she did get went to her children and her grandchildren. Lauren's son was born with birth defects, requiring special care and private school. She put most of the money in a trust for him and also paid off the remainder owing on her father's car to purchase it. Mary Beth attempts to maintain a soft, naive nature, a well-meaning victim of the circumstances of her father's health and stubborn attitude, her sister's evil plans, and Tony's supposed revenge. Things had been chaotic lately, she describes. She had just found out that Linda was purchasing a condo with her abusive ex-husband, and she didn't understand why she kept going back to someone who was so awful to her. Throughout their relationship, Linda refused to go to counseling because she thought she was smarter than everyone. But where Mary Beth was only slightly fed up about Ted, she's furious about Tony. They'd been fighting about him, and even though Mary Beth was happily dating someone else, Linda was still accusing her of secretly seeing him. They ask her what kind of car Linda drives, what her phone number is, her address, and where she can be reached. And then, when they inform her that she's going to be charged with the murder of her father, she's surprised. Mary Beth seemed to have the false impression that if she gave a good enough reason for what she did, if there wasn't anything malicious behind her intent, the whole thing would be understood. The police explain they're there to get the facts, not dole out a sentence. They cuff her, search her, take her personal belongings, and then leave the room after she asks for more tissue. An officer returns with a box, takes the cuffs off her wrists, and locks her inside the interrogation room alone. And for the first time since she sat down, selfishly aware of her fate, Mary Beth cries. When officers arrived at her home to arrest her, Linda was already at another police station. As was their way, Linda had gone from agreeing to move into a condo with Ted to requesting an injunction against him. Thanks to Mary Beth, they were able to reach her by cell phone and instructed her to drive straight home. They'd wait for her there. Linda went into the interrogation unaware of several key things, such as the secret confessions Tony had recorded and the fact the police had already spoken to Mary Beth. By now, they had compared both accounts with the original investigation in 2015. Given those aces up their sleeve, the purpose of the interrogation would be to cross-check stories, search for motive, find out who was responsible for what, and if it was a premeditated act. Detectives were also keen to hear more about Linda's past in the medical field, and whether her father had been a one-off murderer or just another name on a long list of innocent patients. The officers tell her they have a few things they want to talk to her about regarding her husband, and also a couple other things, too. From talking to you in the car, you seem pretty straightforward, the same lead detective assures her, setting up pressure and expectation. And after she's read her rights, Linda tells them she doesn't know why she's there. They start off with a few general questions, basic information that they already know the answer to. She tells them about her siblings, that they were born in Chicago and moved to Florida when she was a toddler. She mentioned that she was a registered nurse on the ride over to the station, and when they ask her to specify her registration, she clarifies that she's actually a medical assistant. She attended Tampa College, and although she assisted the doctor plenty of times with basic setups and procedures, her primary focus was not strictly patient care, like a nurse. Medical assistants work under the direct supervision of a licensed medical practitioner, while nurses have a much greater variety of clinical responsibilities. She wasn't giving morphine drips to patients on death's door. She was helping the doctor remove a mole here, a benign cyst there. If she was helping the doctor with injections, it would have been things like antibiotics or steroids. Linda had exaggerated the power held in her position to anybody who couldn't verify otherwise. Not only was she no angel of death, she'd luckily never had the opportunity. Linda stopped working when she lost her full vision 4 years ago. 4 years ago was when the sheriff's office would have had Anthony Tomaselli's death investigation on file, and the detectives used this as a seamless way to dive in. When he asks her what happens, she recalls the same story she's rehearsed for friends and family many times, to the point where she most likely even believes some aspects of it to be true herself. Linda explains that his partner had died shortly before, and both her and her sister moved in to help him because he had dementia. He had 3/4 of a lung removed years ago, and the day before he died, her father's doctor had called to tell her that his other lung also had a mass. He mentioned he didn't feel good that night, but he fell asleep, happily snoring away. When it was time to get up for work, Linda started making coffee and Mary Beth went to check on her father. She screamed for Linda, who found a pulse, but she'd forgotten about his pacemaker. Linda called the doctor she worked for, frantically explaining that her father wasn't breathing. Her sister called 911. Linda tried CPR until the paramedics got there, and then, in an emotional bout of refusal and devastation, they had to rip her off of his body. After several minutes of letting her tell the entire narrative she'd stuck with for years, detectives let the wall down. They aren't as interested in playing nice with Linda, and they aren't going to let her play dumb. They go into direct confrontation, and Linda gives away her first tell and a warm-up for a defense. Instead of what the story is that they're even talking about, she's more concerned about who the story is from.
We're paying you the compliment of being upfront with you. You need to pay us the same compliment and tell us what actually happened.
Who is giving you information, other information?
Ma'am, I want to hear from you, okay? And I want to talk to you about it, okay? So I know what happened, and I'm giving you the opportunity right now to talk to us and tell us your side of the story.
This is unbelievable.
I agree.
Does my sister know about this?
I know what your sister did.
And you know what my sister did?
I know what she did, and I know what you did. So, right now, it's not to continue to tell us the story that you're telling me is not right. I get your father was sick. He was ill. People make mistakes, okay? And I know everything, okay?
From a trustworthy person, you know everything?
Who's not trustworthy?
Who's not trustworthy?
Somebody obviously told you something that could possibly not be trustworthy. The person is not a trustworthy person.
Linda's arms go from crossed on the table to up in a prayer position, resting in front of her mouth. Her eyes dart back and forth between the detectives. She swallows deep and breathes a little faster. The officer's telling her that he understands the weight this must have been on her this whole time, and she's scrambling for excuses and distractions. I don't believe the person who told you is a trustworthy person. Look at his criminal background. You'll see that he's been in a lot of trouble. She gives a summary of their dating throughout the last several months. They still see each other, weekly, sometimes more. One of the detectives challenges her. If he's so untrustworthy, why do you still see him at least once a week? Partly for the same reason I was still with Ted, she tells him. And what about your relationship with your sister, he asks. We love each other. She tells me everything. We're very close. And detectives move in on this concept of trust between them and secrets that they may share together. She keeps asking the officers who told them any different about that night and what happened. But the second detective steps into the bad cop role to lay out the facts.
But who told you?
I'm just gonna... Okay, let me just walk you through this a little bit, just to bring you up to speed. Okay, the conversation that you had...
Yes.
We were listening to that conversation. Okay?
Okay.
So we can cut to the chase that there was no joking about this. I have a digital crystal clear clarity. So you can read between the lines, okay? I actually had the same clarity with your sister.
About, you talked to her?
About an hour ago. So I'm going to tell you one more time. You're not going to come out on the end of this in a very good fashion because you're telling the truth about what happened. We tried to give you ample opportunity to tell what happened, but now you know that I know what happened.
I want to know who told it.
I just told you that.
Okay.
So we're going to cut through the BS. Agreed?
Agreed.
Okay. Now answer his questions and let's move forward with this. Okay? You understand?
I understand, but you don't have to be rough with me.
Ma'am, I've given you 3 or 4 opportunities to tell the truth, and we were very upfront with you, and you're not being upfront with us. He said, I'm going to be very upfront with you about what happened, and you kind of disrespected him a little bit by not doing that. I'm just trying to put us on the right path here. Do you understand that?
By 26 minutes in, Linda begins to admit defeat. Poking holes in Tony's credibility didn't work. Her next tactic is to shift as much blame on Mary Beth as possible. The night that they found out about the mass on his lungs, she'd held her hand and said to Linda, "We can't let Dad suffer this way." She hadn't been entirely surprised. She was aware that her sister held a lot of anger in her heart against her father and resented him for refusing to go into the care facility. Linda, on the other hand, had nothing but the purest intentions. She loved her father, and as someone with a medical background, felt an obligation to make sure it was done properly and painlessly. She doesn't remember who came up with the idea of using the sleeping pills, but she remembers that it was definitely Mary Beth who mixed them into his drink and gave it to him. Because of Mary Beth's mistake, things had turned out differently.
He opened his eyes, but then he closed them immediately after he opened them. And my sister said, he's obviously not, it's not working.
And he's not dead?
Yeah, he had not died, right. And
how was he acting during this? Just everything was normal, or was he off kilter? Did it have any effect on him at all, or anything?
Oh yeah, he was semi-conscious, I would
say. Okay, understood.
So my sister and I both said, well, we've started euthanizing him. He's now, we have to finish it now.
Linda finally discloses that Lauren was also there, but she'd asked Linda for one of her Ambien and by now was asleep. When they ask her again who came up with the plan and when, she says it was the night before, after Mary Beth's argument with their father. "I'm sorry, I'm in the medical field and I took it as euthanasia," Linda explains. When they ask her what kind of pills were used, she can't recall, naming off a couple he was prescribed, but not Halcyon. When they ask her if she used a pillow before the washcloth, she says she doesn't remember doing that at all. And motive also comes up again, when they ask if it was because her father was a burden to them, but Linda assures them it was to end his suffering. They're trying to show Linda that regardless of whether he was capable of making the best decisions for himself or not, at the end of the day, he was resistant to going, and that was a problem. The more aggressive detective again takes a confrontational stance, reminding Linda that she's an extremely smart woman. She knows that what she did wasn't legal. She says after telling Tony last week and hearing his reaction, she guesses so. But independent of him and his opinion, you must know that what you did was not lawful, correct?
No, I guess it is not legal to do that.
Right. Because if it was legal to do that, you would have came out and just told us what happened. And you didn't do that. You knew there had to be a downside to this.
He already told me that it was not legal to do what we did. I felt I euthanized him and put him on
sedation. I understand.
I have nothing else to say.
No, I understand. But that's because you saw your dad was suffering. I totally understand that. But if you take that part of it out, the act of just doing that is not lawful, is what I'm trying to say. This is where we're at. That's why there's a problem.
They ask about the inheritance, which equaled about $110,000 split in three ways. They also ask if she drinks or does any kind of drugs besides the one she's prescribed, which offends her. She might think this is more slander on Tony's part, but the detectives are just clarifying that being of sound mind is a consistent state for Linda. They also tell her that regardless of her feelings about trusting Tony or not, everything he told the police was true, and she just confirmed it. With that, she's told she's going to be charged with the murder of her father, and she's going to jail today. They also ask if she'd like to talk to Mary Beth, and Linda says yes. She wonders if their conversation will be recorded. The detective doesn't really answer her. She tells them that she has heart medicine she needs to take, but it's not on her. He assures her they'll have everything she needs when she needs it. She also mentions the gun in the glove compartment of her car, which she legally owns. They search her, cuff her, and then she's left alone in silence while the detectives go get Mary Beth. Under the guise of having some alone time to talk, the officers bring in Mary Beth, who's cuffed and holding a glass of water in front of her with both hands, walking slowly, being careful not to spill it. She'd ask the officers for some to take her medication with. Linda keeps her eyes on her the entire time as she sits down with her back towards the camera. The detectives will join the other officers who were watching the interrogations. One thing is certain about both sisters. They loved to talk, and the detectives were curious to see if they'd stay any more when they were left in a room alone. "I don't know what to say," Linda tells her. "What do you mean you don't know what to say?" Mary Beth responds. "I can't say anything." Linda is talking about the fact that they're being recorded, but Mary Beth doesn't care. "You didn't say anything to them?" Linda whispers. "Yes, I had to tell them." And Mary Beth snaps, "So did I, because you told someone." Mary Beth tells her that Tony came to her house last week. She knew she'd told him, and she knew this was coming. "How can you trust someone like that? He was trying to blackmail me to have sex with him, or he'd turn me in." You can tell that even if this is a charade to continue making Tony look like he is incredible, Linda is too pissed off at her sister. She's baffled. Jealous. "Well, I thought I could. And I was having all these horrible dreams with Dad in them, and you weren't speaking to me. I had to talk to someone." Mary Beth doesn't buy that excuse. She's angry that Linda spilled the beans on what they'd promised to take to the grave, regardless of the current status of their relationship. They talk to each other, narrating their repeating stories for the camera. "I told them why we did it. I told them how horrible his health was, how much he was suffering." After a pause of silence, Mary Beth laments, "My life is over." "So is mine," Linda snaps. Mary Beth tells her about how she wanted to take a detachable part of her boot off, that she thought of killing herself with it somehow when she was alone in the interrogation room. Linda is unaffected. She eventually responds in a fed-up tone, "Am I going to be able to take my medicine?" And she tells Mary Beth to slide her purse over to her, mumbling about how they have to let her take it. It's only seconds later that a police officer opens the door and grabs the purse from her, assuring her that she'll get her meds at the jail. After he closes the door, she whispers to Mary Beth, "I guess we're on camera." "Of course we are. Are you stupid?" Mary Beth is fed up with her sister, who in her eyes got them into this mess. She shakes her head in disappointment as Linda figures it out, that Tony must have come here and told them, gotten wired, and recorded her. "I don't think there's anything else to talk about," Linda tells Mary Beth, and they share a few minutes of silence. "Just when my life was getting good after all these years, and now it's over." Mary Beth can't stop feeling sorry for herself, and Linda follows suit. "They have no right to keep my medication from me. I'll have a stroke and die," Linda tells her. "Well, what about me?" Mary Beth whines. "They didn't even ask me what medications I'm on. I'll die in 3 days without my medications." Not only do they find a way to play victim, even when they're being charged for the murder of their father, but they don't even seem to understand the absurdity they prove here. Apparently, both of them would soon be on death's door without medicine, but simultaneously mourning all of the life they would have had left to live if they weren't going to prison. Not once did either of them break their indignance. They continued to tell pieces of their altruistic murder, before again resigning to the fact that it doesn't matter anymore. It's too late. The jig is up.
"My life is over. So is mine. Be in prison the rest of our life. Or we could get the death sentence. You know that, right?"
Police would also bring Lauren in for questioning twice to hear her side of what happened that night in 2015. She explained in detail everything that she remembered, which was quite a bit. Those days in March had been significant for her. By the time her grandfather had passed, she'd been living with him for 10 days. She helped him put together his medicine, gave him rides to the doctor, went to the beach with him every sunset. Her grandfather was the only father figure she'd ever had. She loved him. She worried about him. She'd recently been released from prison and wasn't working at the time, so when her mom, Aunt Linda, and Uncle Charles asked her to move in, she didn't hesitate. She described their visit to the doctor when they discovered the spot on his lungs, and it's true, he had been coughing badly and extra forgetful. He was nostalgic and really missing Shirley. He seemed tired. He accidentally called her Mary Beth sometimes, but it wasn't anything that alarmed her too much. That night, he'd been off. But she always looked back at it thinking that maybe he'd known something, like it was his time. But now, as she recalled the events with a shaky voice, she felt ill at all the lies that had been playing out right before her.
"So when you took the pill, how long was it that you started to feel a little
bit? Probably about 30 minutes, 45 minutes.
And you felt?
I went right and laid down with the TV on in the bedroom.
And you just the door open or closed?
I always shut the door.
Okay.
I always shut the door. And then about 4 or 5, I would say, I heard my mom screaming because my mom had to go to work the next morning. And I hear her screaming, and I come out in the living room, and Linda's on top of him. She's calling the old doctor she used to work for, Dr. Mazur, and she was saying, I think my dad passed away. I'm trying to do CPR. She was on top of his chest, and I remember her pressing his chest. And my mom couldn't call 911. She was shaking too bad. So I went in the bedroom and called, and I told him the address, and I told him that I think my grandpa just had a heart attack. I know that Linda was on top of him because when the paramedics came, they pulled her off of him. And my mom was standing in his doorway, his bedroom doorway, because it was right by the living room. And she was shaking and screaming.
And what else did she say?
She said, he's dead. Oh my God, he's dead.
Lauren was aware about how her mother felt when it came to her grandfather's refusal to go to an assisted living home. She didn't see the big deal and even told her mother to just leave him alone about it because what did it matter? She was living there now and the two of them were getting along really well. Lauren had needed the routine just as much as he did. The two of them could relate in more ways than one in having other people make you feel like a burden. In the last 4 years, they rarely spoke of her grandfather's death, save for a mention on holidays or his birthday. She always got the impression that given how chaotic that night had been and how devastated her mother and aunt were, it was best to not bring him up. Looking back, all the strangeness that she'd brushed off were now elements of a sideshow to distract her. She realized how odd it was that her mother and Aunt Linda had insisted on staying when the entire purpose of Lauren being there was so the two of them wouldn't have to do that. But again, she'd figured that somehow her grandfather had known, and when he dropped his prayer cards and asked his daughters to sit on either side of him, it was to ease the anxiety of the inevitable tunnel he was staring down. And the theatrics of emotion they had both put her through, it was all a lie. The entire thing had been so traumatic for Lauren. The screaming, the crying, the intensity had been all for show. Lauren's pain was just a useful tool in their plot. It felt so cheap and tragic. Her own flesh and blood had betrayed her grandfather and her in ways she couldn't fathom. Thinking of her mother going to prison made her feel like a small child. And she would have gone to her, asked her why, told her how scared she was, but she was on parole herself. In that moment, she didn't have anyone. A wound that had only begun to scar would open once more, and it felt as if her grandfather was dying all over again. Because of some of the things Linda had said during the recordings, police would also bring in the doctor that she had worked under for the last 30 years until 2017, 2 years after the death of her father. When the police ask him if he knows why he's there, he tells them, yes, the two girls, and explains that his daughter had texted him about it after seeing it on the news. He'd actually had trouble sleeping because he found it impossible to believe. Linda had worked in his family practice for 30 years, and because of Mary Beth's job, she often assisted him throughout the years with insurance claims. He found her to be so honest and straightforward. He'd started off in the Navy, and then pharmaceutical sales before settling into general practitioner. Right now, he was mostly working in the pain management field and staring happily at retirement around the bend, maybe in a year's time. As he described the services of his practice, it was clear that Linda's angel of death career had most likely started and ended with her father. Where she had made it sound like she was involved in major medical surgeries and decisions, the doctor would scale her grandiose sense of authority back down to size. She'd been a medical assistant and secretary. She had bookkeeping responsibilities, she'd sign in patients and maintain their medical history records. She helped set up simple surgical procedures or EKG machines. Things people could do to possibly avoid an unnecessarily expensive trip to the emergency room. Very rarely, if ever, would a patient be given an IV. Needles often only came out for blood tests, B12 injections, flu and vaccine shots, or maybe if a patient was severely dehydrated. There would never have been any type of surgery where a patient would have been given medication such as morphine. He did have access to certain classed medication like antidepressants, sleeping pills, and tranquilizers, but they were only in pill form and strictly given out by him alone. She did once help him with procedures that he was doing at another office in Tampa to reduce nicotine cravings in patients, but that was very short-lived, and it would have been similar to a vaccine. This idea that Linda had been some bedside nurse to the dead and dying was just another display of how deeply she was able to deceive herself and others. He'd also seen Linda as a patient and given her prescriptions in the past for different pain medications and sleeping pills. Definitely not Halcyon, though. As a doctor, he'd seen medications come and go because of their negative effects. He noted that it was pretty restricted at least a decade ago, and he knows how intense it can be after seeing his own father take it. Unlike Mary Beth, he had found both Linda and Lauren to be dishonest when it came to money. Over the years, Linda had taken a fair amount of money from him, which was funny, he thought, because he knew Mary Beth to always be the one with financial struggles. When Linda would leave the practice, Mary Beth's daughter Lauren took over her position, and it didn't take him long to notice all the money disappearing. Lauren had no boundaries as an employee representing his business. Sometimes she'd call up patients of his asking if she could borrow money. When she was fired, her boyfriend was extremely angry. Soon after, the doctor's house was robbed. Guns were taken, as well as his Range Rover. The car was ruined during a police chase after the driver crashed into a tree. The driver happened to be the brother of Lauren's boyfriend, and even though there was no evidence linking the conspiracy, the doctor obviously believed that she'd been involved somehow. He sighed as he recalled the car, his favorite car he'd ever had. He'd never be able to afford another one like that. He was still waiting for a date to be set for the trial. But overall, even including the chaos of the robbery, he'd never thought anything like this could be possible of either sister. He'd met Anthony Tomaselli quite a few times over the years. He struck him as a super dad of sorts. Even though the guy was just a retired barber, he paid for everything. He'd come by the practice to drop off payments for Linda's dental work. He got her a facelift. If she needed surgery or specialists, he paid for it. He hadn't seen him in the last 2 years of his life since Linda had left the practice, but before that, he'd always been stable and so nice. He vaguely remembered hearing about Shirley's passing, and then soon after, that Anthony had also died. He'd actually asked Mary Beth about the life insurance specifically once, because he knew she'd always been having money problems. But oddly, she told him that Linda hadn't given her a dime. Maybe this was before they'd split it three ways. Maybe she said it because she lied out of feeling bitter. After both interrogations, recordings, Lauren's interview, and this, it was clear that there was no logical way to figure out what either sister was thinking. Both had perceptions like funhouse mirrors, warping reality and twisting it to fit their narrative. Authorities felt confident that they had everything they needed. Almost 4 years to the day, both Mary Beth and Linda were arrested on March 5, 2019, following their interrogations, charged with first-degree murder and held without bail. By May, the prosecution announced that they would not be seeking the death penalty, which meant that both would face the possibility of life in prison. In Florida, capital crimes involve aggravating factors, and even by the sisters' own admittance, both in secret and with the police, they said it wasn't planned or premeditated, and it wasn't for money. Taking those factors into account, each sister would eventually take a deal, pleading guilty to second-degree murder and avoiding a trial. The evidence was stacked against them, all by their very own words. There was no use drawing things out for nothing but an expensive spectacle. Second-degree murder still involves intentionally taking a life, without the forethought of planning that first-degree murder charges require. Linda would receive 20 years in prison in March 2021, and the following month, after having agreed to testify against her own sister, Mary Beth was sentenced to 15. Tony would later tell the media, "I'm not afraid of anything, but it was bone-chilling having someone telling me they killed somebody, the ending of a life, hearing about how it happened. There's nothing like it. It's not a movie, it's real life." And real life was all they would have left. The sisters would appear hollow-eyed and cold in their prison mugshots, Mary Beth much older and tired, her face thinned out since her first booking photo. Linda, using insider secrets from other inmates, still managing her signature eyeliner, blush, and brows. Behind bars of concrete and barbed-wired fence, outside appearances still remain more important than the truth. Every night she dreams of sunsets and vodka sodas, the sound of ocean waves lapping the shore. She waits for her father, for him to sit down beside her and tell her like before that it's all okay. But he never comes, and so she just sits there, listening to the salty sway of her bitter guilt, alone in her nothingness until she wakes up tired once again.